ABC AFL Daily is the best conversation in footy. Hosted by Corbin Middlemass and Ben Cameron, alongside regulars like Mick Malthouse.
I mean, I don't remember too many games, but it's one of the ones I remembered. It was just that physical.
Bob Murphy.
Where do you guys get off thinking you can pick and choose?
And more. It keeps you in the loop with the biggest stories in the AFL and the number one analysis in the game. ABC AFL Daily. 5 eps a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Cabo Verde with a result of a lifetime in their debut on the world stage, and they have held Spain to nil. Extraordinary achievement, defending for their lives. And this will be remembered for a long, long time.
Is it just me, or has this been the best men's World Cup of our lifetime? A tournament blinding us with star power. Haaland to Messi to Kane, Bellingham, Ronaldo and Mbappe, amongst others. Feel great runs from a sliding scale of little guys. Selfishly, the Socceroos gave us heaps to talk about, and all three host nations gave their fans reasons to dream. And yet, the hydration breaks were a grim nod to the power of the dollar, altering the sport from halves to quarters under the guise of safety. We had an alleged US presidential pardon for an American player. One team and one referee had their tournament curtailed for political reasons. The man in charge, Gianni Infantino, is already talking about expanding the next World Cup to 64 teams. It's been the best of times. It's been the worst of times. I'm Patrick Stack. This is ABC Sport Daily World Cup Special. Craig Foster is here to talk about the FIFA World Cup, the best of it, the worst of it. Craig, welcome. I want to talk about this tournament, and it's such a conflicting thing to discuss in a weird way because I cannot remember enjoying a World Cup more in my lifetime. So why do I feel uneasy about the way this tournament has gone down in some ways?
Yeah, you should do. If you care about football or if you care about sport or if you care about people, and so many of us care about all of those things, this is not unique to the 2026 World Cup. Of course, we had really serious issues about Qatar. We also had issues around Russia. You know, people who really love sport, and particularly those of us who love football and played it and have been involved in the game for a long time, we want it to be good. We want it to be a force for good. We want it to live up to all of its slogans and all of the like. So it's very normal that we feel uneasy about the way that FIFA conducts itself, about the way that the host nation, US, for example, in particular, conducts itself, about the way that fans are being treated, or, you know, officials and all of these types of things, because, you know, we want the tournament to be good in every way. Unfortunately, that's not life. That's not the world. And therefore, it takes people within the sport itself and without, including politicians and otherwise, to constantly be hammering on about the inconsistencies and the injustices to try and keep shaping sport and shaping global football in a way that it can genuinely, you know, be a better force in the world.
I mean, so much of it, I think, is drawn into the Fallerin Balogun overturning of the red card suspension, because there's been little sort of cuts along the way. The expansion from 32 to 48 teams, which I think you could make a case has been a big success in some ways. The hydration breaks, turning the game from halves to quarters, a halftime show at the World Cup final running 30 minutes, all feels a little bit like, oh, you could kind of make a case for these things. Ultimately, overturning a red card, the erosion of trust that that has driven through the game feels so pronounced, Craig.
I think that's right. And it's really interesting to me because obviously I work outside the game a lot as well in human rights advocacy and, you know, talk about international law a lot and those types of aspects. And so it's interesting to see that for all of the kind of deleterious things that FIFA are doing with the tournament itself and the hosts and effectively breaking the ethics and rules of integrity of FIFA and all these things, the outrage is much, much more pronounced when it goes to the on-field play. I think that's normal because, you know, you've got billions of fans around the world who aren't too concerned about the way FIFA acts, but they're deeply concerned about whether a red card is overturned improperly or not. You know, to me, it's a metaphor for the broader world. You know, the way Trump basically, you know, imposed his will on FIFA and overcame the obvious regulations.
Yeah, I did. I spoke to Johnny, who's highly respected, who's produced the most successful World Cup in history by, they say, four times.
There's those bigger themes as well, which a lot of people in sport tend not to want to think about too much. Nonetheless, yeah, that political intervention was powerful because it was so brazen and public. So it's normal that that disgrace really outraged people everywhere. And I guess what sport does, what football does better than any other sport, is it just provides a window to where the world is at a particular point in time. And this is where we are in 2026.
From a footballing perspective, Craig, it feels like this tournament has been a success. Like, no shortage of scepticism about the expansion. As I said, from 32 to 48 teams. I think it probably made the event richer. Gianni Infantino is now talking about expanding to 64 teams. His argument is around participation and the right to dream, which is silly because every nation has the opportunity through qualification, but almost makes more sense to have 64 in terms of the groups and the mechanics of how you would divvy up a tournament like that. How do you feel about the creep of expansionism?
Yeah, I'm very worried. I was skeptical but supportive of 48, only for the reason that Australia has profited from expansions in the past, and so that's pretty hypocritical for us to say, well, this we philosophically oppose it. Because obviously it went from 13 to 16 to 24. And then by the time it hit 32, that's when we were able to get back in because of that extra place and a half in Asia. And we know what the impact of that has been on Australian society, not just on Australian football. It's just been absolutely immense for the country. And we see where the Socceroos Matildas are at the moment. So, and I think there'll be books written about the influence of football and what happened post 2006, you know, in 20 or 30 years' time with hindsight. So the 48 teams has been quite brilliant. We were, of course, concerned that there would be a great disparity in quality, and that was momentarily backed up with a 7-1 over Curaçao by Germany. And we thought, oh, gee, there's going to be a few blowouts here. Nonetheless, even the Curaçao fans and team and everyone came out after that game and rightly said, well, okay, yeah, we copped 7 goals, but you people need to understand how important it is for us to be here.
There's Lucadia, and there's the strike, and there's the equaliser! Oh, unbelievable! Livano Comanencia! History in Houston! A nation of scarcely more than 100,000 souls has just silenced millions.
And then after that, of course, they were highly competitive. And then Cabo Verde, you know, have made an exclamation mark on the positive nature of the rise to 48, in my view. So it's been brilliant. You know, and you've had new fans, and I've enjoyed seeing new countries being there. Some of them, Jordan, Uzbekistan, the Asians, particularly, really struggled. Nonetheless, they'll learn from it. They will improve their systems. They'll improve their coaching. They'll decide they need to send coaches to Europe to learn, and all the things that we've done in the last 20 years. Yes, it's true that one of the issues with 48 was that it's not a natural approach through group stage, and you have to have all of these third places now coming into a round of 32 and the like. We saw some of the games, including ours against Paraguay, actually, where Paraguay were clearly not really that interested in winning the game. 64, though, it does seem to be getting too high now. We've only got 211 countries in the world. So the other issue is around the length of time that the World Cup takes, and now it's about a balance between club and international football. And so there's two reasons, or perhaps more, but why Infantino wants it. Number one is because this 48-team World Cup was a lot more games, a lot more income, and so he's delivering a massive, unprecedented profit, and that's what keeps him in the seat. And he effectively pays off all the federations around the world. He's not alone. All presidents have done that, but that's how they stay in. So more profit for him is politically convenient. Therefore, 64 teams makes perfect sense. It also politically makes sense because then smaller African nations, smaller CONCACAF nations, and elsewhere, even smaller Asian nations, can now have their opportunity to be in the World Cup for the first time ever. And that helps him politically to try and change the statute so that he can stay as FIFA president. The fact that he's still there given what happened with Balogun, given what happened with the Peace Prize and all these things, just demonstrates that, our global football has absolutely no standards in terms of ethics or integrity anyway, because it should have been gone some time ago. You can see that UEFA will be against it, and of course the club environment will be against it, because now there is a very serious challenge between international football and club football, and Infantino is fighting effectively against Seferin, the head of UEFA, for the use of players. The neutral party, which is FIFPro, which is the global representative body of professional footballers, they released research, I think it was last year, maybe the year before, where they're now saying rightly that the players are being stretched too far. The best players are playing in excess of 70 games a year. And if you continue to expand, including Club World Cup, including an expanded World Cup, and of course the club system wants to continue to expand as well, then in the end they're going to break. This is the fight between Infantino and on one side and Seferin and the clubs on the other. And the players are, if you like, the meat in the sandwich, and it has to give at some point.
Speaking of things that sort of might change forever, hydration breaks. I mean, they've turned the game from halves into quarters at this tournament, and Infantino's on the record about arguing that this was not about money.
This decision is based purely on the sporting equity and the sporting merits. And I want to stress this because I hear as well it's about money or things like that. It is not. We don't make $1 more revenues in FIFA with these hydration rates.
The final, we're going to see a 30-minute halftime show. That's like a huge gap in the flow of what we've traditionally understood to be a FIFA Men's World Cup final. Do you think we're seeing the game change forever? Like, are we now looking at a world where we're going to see a slow creep of quarters across football?
Yeah, I saw a great video the other day with Diego Maradona, of course, I'm talking about, many, many years ago when he was asked about another World Cup in America. I'm not sure if some of your listeners will have seen it. And he said, oh, well, what they'll do is they'll change it into quarters so they can have more sponsor breaks. Infantino has said, as you pointed out, that it wasn't about money. FIFA's getting no money from the sponsors.
Because all our contracts were signed well ahead of the decision to have these breaks. Broadcasters, maybe, they generate more. I don't know, that's great for them. But for us, we make zero additional revenue.
Oh, I don't support it at all. I think it's changing the nature of the game to more like basketball, for example. That's obviously happened. It only took a few games for the coaches to work it out. The Swiss coach was the first to admit that he used the sponsor break to change his team and, in fact, substitute players immediately after. Change system, change approach, change players, and to explain that to the players during that break. So that was the first time that it was acknowledged. This is a tactical break. And of course, every team then profited from it, and it completely changed the game. Some people like it. I don't. But we should acknowledge Australia also used it to our benefit. In the game against Egypt, which we ultimately lost on penalties, in the first half, we did not start well, and then Tony Popovich actually changed the approach at the sponsor break, and after that, for the next 20 minutes, the final 20 minutes of the first half, Australia had the ball a lot more. In fact, we started to play football. And then in the second half, things changed again, and we were very much on the back foot. That's the reality. You know, it has become two coach interventions, tactical interventions that we did not have in the game before. I liked the fact that coaches could stand on the sideline and scream as much as they want, but 45 minutes is a long time for players to have to manage the game effectively on their own. That means a lot of pre-match preparation, but that can go out the window as soon as the game starts. The opponent can start in a different way, different system, different tactics, different approach, and the players have to either be fully prepared for those eventualities or they have to work it out on the run. I love that about football, but like many things, including the halftime break now being doubled, as far as I can see, for the World Cup final, the very nature of football is being changed, not just politically, not just in terms of the statutes, but the actual on-field nature of football itself is being changed by FIFA and particularly by Infantino.
Can you see a world where we're going to have quarters across football as an ongoing thing at all levels?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised because it's obvious that the coaches support it. The coaches mostly support every intervention they can possibly have, right? But that doesn't mean it's good for football. Of course, sponsors will support it, and FIFA will probably support it. A lot of FIFA will support it, and the members, because it's going to deliver more money. It's going to deliver more money for the Club World Cup, you know, for Champions League, for all of these things. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're going to push for it to come in. I just hope that the fans around the world push back.
What I think we've seen over the course of this tournament, and we sort of spoke about it with the Balogun story, is the erosion of trust. And to see the conspiracies, Craig, around the Argentina favouritism pushed by the Egyptian team, the Swiss team.
No fair, no fair. Referee, no fair.
I normally look at things like that and sort of dismiss them as the ramblings of bitter losers. But yeah, it's because of all the things that you're talking about, you sort of can't afford not to then at least examine it. Like, and I don't think that Argentina have been actually had the deck stacked in their favour. But is there a sense that these things collectively are making us fail to trust what we're seeing with our eyes?
I think it's broader than that. And this is where I'm probably a bit different to most ex-players and even broadcasters and the like, is, you know, the more politically attuned you are as well, and many, you know, of the greatest footballers always have been, you know, Socrates and Maradona and Cantona now and many others, and they're the ones that I like and appreciate. But this is actually happening, you know, around the world. For example, you know, we've had in the last 2 years the whole Epstein file issue in the US, which I think has now uncovered, you know, a level of what were previously considered conspiracy theories and put us all in a place where we're now saying, well, yes, we have to give some regard to points of view which previously we would have automatically written off. The issue about FIFA as well is I think they had a lot of control of much of the global media 20, 30 years ago. And if you remember when the Blatter era came to an end with an FBI intervention, there was only one or two journalists around the world who became famed for actually trying to hold them accountable. In posterity now, they are recognised as having been correct, but completely attacked and externalised by FIFA, not allowed into Congress meetings, thrown out of all things, simply because they were there asking the right questions. Corruption and conspiracies are not a 2026 phenomenon either globally and certainly not in football. And therefore, those who are attuned to the work of FIFA and the game and just geopolitics, basically, I think have lost innocence to think that football is not political or that football does not have these problems throughout its history anyway. This tournament has been different only because so many of them have been surfaced publicly. And as you said, the Balogun situation, because it was so public, and the admission by Trump of his intervention.
You know, it's one thing to penalize somebody for the game, but how do you penalize them for a game that hasn't been played yet? It's very unfair. You can't do that. So, yes, I asked for a review by FIFA. I spoke to a man who's highly respected.
That has exacerbated all of these other concerns, but we can't say that any of them are irrelevant. I mean, when it comes to Argentina and Messi and Ronaldo and others, it is quite clear that they are given the positive benefit of rules in a way that others aren't. I mean, Ronaldo's suspension for 3 games, he served 1 game pre-World Cup suspension, should never have been, taken away. I mean, he should have missed the first 2 games of this FIFA World Cup. That's just a fact. And why wasn't he? Is because he's Cristiano Ronaldo. Like, it's just that simple. But that shouldn't have happened. And so does Lionel Messi, as a great player, get the benefit of the doubt in a number of moments in games? Of course he does. That's the way, not just that football works, but actually that's the way that the world works.
As I said out of the gate, it has been an incredible tournament, maybe the favourite of my lifetime from a World Cup perspective. How much credit does FIFA deserve? Because ultimately they've run this event and it's been a joy to watch.
Yeah, I think the decision to go to 48 was great. So, you know, they take all credit for that because, you know, that was Infantino's baby, really. I think it's been outstanding. So, you know, he's done a great job there. So how much credit you know, or positivity do they deserve from football fans? The honest answer to that question is it depends on the level of generality that you want to go to. So if you, you know, and this is fair enough, if football fans just want to stay on the field, you know, and just be like entranced by the football, well, you know what? Every World Cup is magnificent. I mean, we had concerns prior to Russia. I mean, you know, in on SBS in 2018, we brought one of the heads of Amnesty in Russia, in fact, onto the program to talk about the anti-gay laws and all of these things. So Russia had huge issues. Qatar had, there was around 6,000 people killed building the stadium in Qatar. And virtually no one cared. I mean, the players were literally playing on the bones of migrant workers in Qatar. But it's clear that most people in football, as soon as the ball is kicked, and I'm guilty of this as well, we just become entranced by the game and we just fall in love with, you know, with the storylines and even with the controversies, but with the beautiful goals, the wonderful players, the greats of the game, that's why we love it. But ultimately, the tournament itself has a lot, you know, it has a lot of aspects which are deeply, deeply concerning, whether it's the treatment of various teams, whether it is the treatment of Somalian referee and all of these things. Our memories of the tournament on field are always amazing. I can tell you about from 06, I can tell you about 1982. Like, I'm not sure this one was better than that one. That was the great Socrates team. Every tournament we remember very fondly. They're amazing times to live through. It just depends on whether you want to just stay focused on the field or, like me and many others around the world, you also focus on the game because we want the game to be the best it can possibly be. And therefore, you know, we have to hold it accountable for that. And in that respect, this tournament actually has been one of the very worst global sporting events in modern times.
It's so interesting to hear the duality of the way that you're appreciating this tournament. And I do want to finish, you know, with the game that is so close to your heart and understanding what you have loved on field for the tournament. What has been the story of the tournament for you, you know, in a World Cup seemingly defined by a series of individuals? It seems as though the collective excellence of Spain will go in as favourites to the final. But when you look at this tournament on field, what has been the story for you?
This tournament has been defined by the small newcomers and also by the legends. So, you know, you've got Cabo Verde and the new nations who came and proved that they deserve the right. We saw their fans and the delight, which they will carry for the rest of their lives, intergenerationally, actually. They'll pass on to their children. You know, the time they spent in 2026 watching their country for the first ever time in a World Cup. And that's very, very special. So that's the purity of football and of global sport, that it can provide those moments for people. Secondly, this has been excellent because despite all of the off-field issues and controversies, you've seen the world come together at a time when it was necessary and demonstrate this solidarity through football, this global party that the world cannot have in any other way. And then you had the greatness of Lionel Messi and that whole question around Cristiano Ronaldo, who mostly failed with Portugal. And what Messi has done, carrying again his nation all the way to the World Cup final, he has demonstrated the level of greatness required to do that in consecutive World Cups. He's put himself in a pantheon, perhaps, where he stands alone. He certainly does statistically and in many respects. So those are the things I think will be remembered from this World Cup. There's been beautiful, beautiful storylines. There's been incredible images and videos of fans celebrating together, getting to know each other. The intercultural collaboration has been phenomenal. The world coming together has been magnificent and timely. You know, and that's the beauty of a World Cup.
Craig Foster, appreciate your time today. Looking forward to the World Cup final.
Yep, let's see how we go with the final. Should be a great one.
That is it for today. Thanks to Poppy Penny for producing this episode. Thanks to SBS for the extra audio. Back after the World Cup final with Mark Schwarzer Monday morning. Who you got? Argentina? Spain? It's going to be a doozy. See you soon.